Good evening. I'm with you now. A wise man once said, sometimes church leaders, people like me, are unhelpful in that we want people to do more stuff and give more time, and we don't take the rhythm of Sabbath and rest seriously. Which is a great setup for me this week, where my assigned topic is serving. So thanks, Matt. But maybe these two messages do go together a bit more than would be initially evident. We'll see about that. But my name's Ian. It's great to be with you tonight. And I'm a partner here at Maybridge, for any of you that haven't met me before. And we're currently looking at the topic of a healthy household during all of our meetings. And basically, we're looking at what it means for us to serve Jesus as a community. And a big part of that is, of course, serving. What do I mean by serving? I mean investing your time in things that benefit the local community, your time and your energy into things that are beyond just yourself. Now, that could be formal serving, like being on a rota. This meeting tonight, it only happens because people turned up and they put the coffee on and they put the chairs out and they switched the PA on and they rehearsed some songs and all kinds of other things. It doesn't just come out of nowhere. But equally important in any community like this one is that informal serving that happens that you can never rota. Things like having people round for a meal, being hospitable, babysitting, dropping off meals for people that are in need, helping somebody move house, that's been something that's happened recently, meeting up with people that need a listening ear. All of those things are really vital, and part of being part of a healthy household is that we all play our part. Everybody has something to give, different things at different times. We have different capabilities and capacities, but we all have something to bring, and it's all important. Now, I think there are two equal and opposite mistakes that we can make as Christians when we think about our contribution and our work or service. First one is that our work doesn't matter because God's in control. And the second one is we know what we're doing, so we don't need God. Now, that second one is normally a bit more subtle than expressed on the screen. It's more of a complacency or a self-confidence rather than a literal rejection of God. And confession time. I can often get a fair bit into preparing a talk like this one before realising I haven't actually prayed about it. Shocking, I know. I'm certainly guilty of simply getting on with things in my own strength. Now, these two mistakes are highlighted in the first passage that we're looking at today, which is Psalm 127, verses 1 to 2. The first verse is very familiar to us all. It says, "Unless the Lord builds the house, those who build it labour in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchman stays awake in vain." So we're going to do a little bit of interaction here, okay? I'm going to ask a question, and I'm going to give you the answers as well, but two different answers, okay? I'm going to ask the question. If you're on this side, the answer is the Lord, and if you're on this side, the answer is the labourers, okay? Who builds the house? Absolutely right. You all got it spot on. Well done. Okay, next question. This side, you're going to say the Lord. This side, you're going to say the watchman. Okay? Who watches over the city? Wow, you're good tonight. Absolutely correct. Both answers are true. But there's a warning in here that very easily we can slip into routine, senseless, vain effort, even around important things like building houses or watching over the cities or what metaphorically that might symbolize. And we can just become very routine over those things because we forget the word, and this is the word of today, the word unless. Can we say that together? Unless. We're called to work hard. We're called to serve hard. We're called to take our contribution incredibly seriously. But unless it starts with the Lord, unless it's in collaboration with him, and unless it's in recognition and empowered by him, it's in vain. Psalm 127 goes on, verse 2, a lesser known part of it says, "It is in vain that you rise up early and go late to rest, eating the bread of anxious toil, for he gives to his beloved sleep." I love the poetry of that part, eating the bread of anxious toil. It's beautiful, isn't it? Do you ever feel like that? You wake up early, you go to bed late, you work yourself to the bone, getting no rest, anxiously toiling just to get the bare essentials out of life. Or even when your anxious toil makes you wealthy, it can seem pointless and empty. Unless it starts with the Lord, unless we recognize that we are his beloved, and then we learn to see purpose in getting out of bed. We see purpose in all we do, even the mundane things and the routine things that we just have to do to get through life. We can begin to see them as part of God's plan and purpose. And when we find that, we find that God gives us rest that revives us. He gives to his beloved sleep. He gives us rest that revives when the work that we're doing is fruitful and not in vain. Now, we're going to continue to look at this theme by looking at a well-known story of Jesus, which is the feeding of the 5,000. We're going to look at the telling of it in Matthew chapter 14, verses 13 to 21. It starts saying, "When Jesus heard what had happened, he withdrew by boat privately to a solitary place." Just pause there. What had happened? Jesus had just heard that his cousin, John the Baptist, had been executed. So he's had some really, really bad news. He's grieving. And it seems completely reasonable that Jesus would withdraw himself to a private place. He'd need a bit of solitude. But we continue. It says, "Hearing of this, the crowds followed him on foot from the towns. And when Jesus landed, saw a large crowd." Now, I don't know about you, but if I put myself in Jesus' shoes, I'm audibly groaning at this point, maybe even angry. I mean, can't they leave me alone for one moment? Do they have no respect for my boundaries? That would seem a very reasonable reaction, unless you're Jesus, because it says he had compassion on them and he healed their sick. So even in Jesus' time of need, he let compassion rise up and spur him to action. He poured himself out for the needy, even out of his great need. As evening approached, the disciples came to him and said, "This is a remote place and it's already getting late. Send the crowds away so that they can go to the villages and buy some food." So not only had this crowd of thousands followed him into the wilderness, they seemingly hadn't thought ahead to actually bring some food for themselves. And the disciples point this out to Jesus. "Send them away," they say. "Send them to the villages. Let them go and sort themselves out and buy themselves some food." The people should take responsibility for their own mistakes. Fix themselves up. You know, this isn't our problem. But Jesus replies, "They do not need to go away. You give them something to eat." You can imagine the disciples hearing this. They're the ones that have noticed the number of people, the huge, vast crowds, and the distinct lack of food or takeaway restaurants. The sums just don't add up. In fact, they're so far off, it's not even close. But they rummage around to see what they can pull together. "We have only 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish, they answered. 5 loaves of bread, 2 fish, 5,000 people. That just doesn't quite add up. The maths isn't mathing. "Unless, bring them here to me," he said. And he directed the people to sit down on the grass. Taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish and looking up to heaven, he gave thanks and broke the loaves. Then he gave them to the disciples, and the disciples gave them to the people. Still 5 loaves and 2 fish, but something happened as the disciples collaborated with the work that Jesus had started. Jesus instigates, but the disciples cooperate, despite, I'm sure, feeling rather foolish, because the task they're given is utterly impossible. Unless they all ate and were satisfied. And the disciples picked up 12 basketfuls of broken pieces that were left over. The number of those who ate was about 5,000 men, besides women and children. 5 loaves, 2 fish, and 5,000 men plus women and children were fed, satisfied, and there were leftovers. Now, this isn't just a crazy story to kind of make us go, wow, that's crazy. There's a real serious message in this about service. A few key points here I want to highlight. Jesus was in a low place, but he decided to serve anyway. Now, don't hear me wrong. I'm not saying that it's never appropriate to just lock yourself away and have a cry, to get that solitude. There are times where that might be the right thing to do, and we certainly shouldn't be numbing our pain with incessant activity. But there are also times when, despite our preference, despite our very reasonable justification, the best thing for us is to actually get out and to serve anyway. And perhaps that's part of where our healing is found. Secondly, Jesus wasn't the one to administrate the miracle. It was in the disciples' hands that the miracle happened. He used the raw materials humans had brought, and it transformed as they gave it out, and multiplied as they gave it out. And it's the same pattern we see in Psalm 127. You could say, unless the Lord distributes the food, the people distributing the food do so in vain. They'd have run out in seconds. There's this crucial collaboration scene here, but the contribution of the disciples is essential. And it completely undermines the first mistake that we looked at the start, that our effort doesn't matter because God's in control. He used the disciples. Thirdly, he used something very ordinary, bread and fish, most basic staple food of the ancient Near East, but it satisfied them. In fact, it was so abundant that there were these 12 baskets of leftovers. It's an ordinary offering, a small offering, but extraordinary outcomes. And that's what serving God is like. We don't bring anything special. We don't need to wait until we have what we think is something special to bring. We bring our ordinary offering, and we bring it under the direction and blessing of him, and it multiplies in its effectiveness. One of the disciples who was involved in this miracle was Peter. And those that have been coming along to Maybridge for a while will know that we've been studying Peter's 2 letters to the early church. And Peter was deeply changed by his discipleship to Jesus, by living amongst him or alongside him and seeing how he lived and seeing the example that he gave. And so in the letters that he wrote to the church, there's this one quote here in 1 Peter 4, verse 8, and it says, "Above all, love each other deeply, because love covers over a multitude of sins. Offer hospitality to one another without grumbling. Each of you should use whatever gift you have received to serve others, as faithful stewards of God's grace in its various forms. If anyone speaks, they should do so as one who speaks the very words of God. If anyone serves, they should do so with the strength God provides, so that in all things God may be praised through Jesus Christ. To him be the glory and the power forever and ever. Amen." These words were written to us as well. These words were written to Maybridge. Above all, love each other deeply. It all starts with love. As John says, we love because he first loved us. And Peter is calling us to love each other deeply, love in the way that Jesus loves us and as demonstrated by Jesus. Because most major religions, they most think of God as being loving or being kind, but Christianity is really unique in that God demonstrates his love for us. in that while we were still sinners, we were separated from him, we were doing our own thing, we were rejecting him, he died for us. Because love is not love without being backed by action. It's easy in our own relationships, in our marriages, in our family life, for there to be, for us to say we love each other and everything, but as time goes on and the busyness of life consumes us, the intentionality of serving one another, doing things with and for one another, that can fade out. But it's those very things that are both the evidence of the love, but also the sustainer of it. And it mustn't be neglected. And the same goes for our church community. We can say we love our church and the people in it, but what are the ways that we can show that? Peter mentioned some. Offering hospitality without grumbling, using the gifts that we've received to serve each other as faithful stewards of God's grace in various forms. Because we've all received these gifts, we've all received things that are not just for us, they're not to keep inside, but they're to use to bless others. And we have that responsibility, it says, to steward that grace. Where do we use it? How do we use it? We have a unique purpose in the gift that has been given to us. And as it continues, if anyone speaks, they should do so as one who speaks the very words of God. If anyone serves, they should do so with the strength God provides, so that in all things God may be praised through Jesus Christ. To him be the glory and the power forever and ever. Amen. In all things God may be praised. It all starts with love, and it all ends with God being praised. He loves us. We love him. We learn to love others as God loved us. And we serve others in God's strength. And in all of that, love is returned to God. We are never the point or the focus of this service. If we're doing it seeking credit or fame, then we're all out of alignment and we're literally doing things in vain. We may have brought the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, but we can't feed the 5,000. Now, returning to the quote we looked at the beginning, how do we square this circle of serving more, yet also taking seriously the call to true rest? And if you weren't here last week, I do encourage you to give that message a listen on the podcast. It's an important one. If we're made to serve like Jesus, if we're called to serve like Jesus, well, he made himself available even in the midst of great grief. He had compassion on people even when he wanted nothing more than just to be by himself in solitude. He literally, ultimately gave up his life so that others could live. If we're to serve like the Apostle Paul, well, he describes his life as being poured out like a drink offering. In other words, his life was entirely sacrificed for the cause. If we're to obey his teaching in the letter to the Thessalonians, we're to never tire of doing what is good. And it's easy for this to all sound a bit like eating the bread of anxious toil, like it would lead us to being burnt out, exhausted, frustrated, and bitter. But what's that word again? Unless. Unless we do it with the strength God provides. Unless we start from a place of love rather than duty. Unless we wait on the Lord to renew our strength. Unless we remember that he loves us and gratefully accept the true rest that he grants his beloved. In those circumstances, the outcome of sacrificial service can be an abundance of joy, even though it does cost. Because the type of serving that we're called to, we'll feel it. It will inconvenience us. It will involve sacrifice, because sacrifice is at the very heart of the Christian faith. But this type of service is a vital part of our expression of faith and an essential part of our discipleship and our worship of God. Now, we're all at different stages in life. We have different challenges in life, and what an appropriate amount of service looks like will be different for all of us. That's not something that can be prescribed. But here's my challenge to you today. If you think about your service to the church right now, do you feel it? And I'm not just talking about rotas and things like that. There's all these informal ways of serving as well. Do you feel it? Does it cost you? Does it at times inconvenience you? Now, I know there's some people here that are all over the rotas, and it very much does cost you. And this challenge is not for you. Maybe your challenge was actually last week. But if not, ask yourself whether you've got a bit more to give. And ask God to grant you the strength in which to do it. Now, my two sons are really into bouldering. And yesterday we went to Boulder Brighton with them and a few people from church as well. And the climbs there are numbered 1 to 8, with 1 being the easiest and 8 being the hardest. Now, my comfort zone is around 3, but my boys, their comfort zone is more around 6. Now, I'm not particularly bothered about progressing my bouldering career, funnily enough, but if I was, I would not just do 3s. I'd be doing 4s constantly until they became comfortable for me. Then I'd be doing 5s until they became comfortable for me. I'd be progressing myself. And it's the same thing if we're serious about progressing our discipleship with Jesus. You don't stop where you're comfortable, because that's a place where you don't need God's strength. If we're only feeding a handful of people, then our 5 loaves and our 2 fish is absolutely fine. But rather, with the strength God provides, you push beyond yourself and you watch your capacity grow. Now, to just get really practical, I want people to be aware of some of the opportunities that there are to put this into practice. And as I said, and I'll say again, it's not just about rotas, it's not just about formal serving, but there is something about this intentionality of signing up and committing to something that I think is really helpful, and it's necessary also for the church. So if you want to take a picture of the screen, there's some things there that you might want to think of, and there's an email at the bottom as well. If you want to get involved in any of those, you can reach out. Because as a church, we've seen a lot of growth recently, which is great, but it also brings challenges. And there's more things to do. So have a think about that if there's anything that God is maybe prompting you to do. Reach out to the office.